Investigators are seeking the public's help in identifying the person. Community organizers in San Francisco are calling on city leaders to condemn what they call ongoing racist attacks on local Palestinian, Arab, and Muslim communities. That's after two Clarion Alley murals commemorating Palestinians were defaced this week. Chris Gazala is a Palestinian artist who contributed to one of the murals, which included the faces of Palestinian journalists, activists, and civilians who have been killed. The words "Stop Terrorism" and "Stop Hamas" were spray-painted over the faces on the mural.
All my time goes to fixing my murals. It goes to, I don't have time to like create new stuff, and I'm drained, you know?
Gazala says his murals featuring Palestinians have been defaced multiple times, especially in recent months. I'm Tara Seiler, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. You're listening to KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highlands, Sacramento. It's 4 o'clock.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals who want to join an inclusive and unique culture. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers.
It wasn't so much good news, bad news in this morning's jobs report. It was more good news, huh, that's interesting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Amazon Business, helping provide a smarter, easier way to get the supplies businesses need to thrive. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying.
In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today. This one is the 7th of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today where we pretty much begin every first Friday of the month with the jobs report. 272,000 new jobs in this economy, as you have surely heard by now, way beating everybody's best guesses. That is, obviously, the good news. The unemployment rate, and this is the, that's interesting news, moved up to 4%. Here to share their insights on that and much else that happened in this economic week are Anna Swanson. She's at the New York Times. Neela Richardson, she is at ADP. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
So, Anna Swanson, let me start with you. Gut check, what do you think of this jobs report?
It was a confusing one. I mean, there was a big contradiction between the two sort of data sources that underlie the report, and they told different stories about kind of a pretty basic question, were there more people working last month or fewer? The business survey gave a picture of a really strong economy. There were big job gains, wage growth picking up. But then the other portion of it gave a much weaker picture with the unemployment rate ticking up. So I think it mostly highlights that, you know, 1 month of data does not make a trend, The end result is a pretty mixed, inconclusive picture about, the exact toll that interest rates are having on the economy right now.
Neela, first of all, do you agree mixed and inconclusive?
Yes, it was a tale of two surveys instead of a tale of two cities, right? It was the best of times in the establishment survey with businesses, again, healthcare, and even the government adding jobs. And it was pretty worrying on the household side. These 60,000 people that are reached out to every month, they said that about 408,000 was the estimate left the labor force. So that's not just a tick up in unemployment, which it is still very low, but that number of people who fell out of the labor market is actually fairly concerning. So you juxtapose these two and you get this abstract painting of, of little pattern, very contrasting picture.
Let me ask you this, though, Neela, and I stay with you because you are the trained economist in the room. Is this not the opposite of what the Fed wants to see, right? The Fed wants fewer jobs added and the unemployment rate to stay low, and now they're getting lots of jobs and the unemployment rate goes up.
I think what the Fed really wants is just inflation to come down. And however you get to that point, they'll take it. What's mystifying, I think, from the Fed seat is that the data points aren't lining up in a direction that points to a conclusive action, right? So you take this data and you match it with some other data, job openings fell, first quarter GDP was weaker than expected. There's no consistent storyline here through the data points. And so that puts them back in this position of being data dependent, but not knowing what data to depend on. And that's a hard place to be for them.
And it's a hard place to be for the rest of us. Let me ask you this, though, Anna. If the Fed is going to be data dependent and the data is confusing at best, they're not going to do anything, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think overall it just reinforces this idea that, you know, the Fed just needs to take more time to wait and see what effect higher interest rates are having. If, you know, the picture had been, a lot of people had expected the picture to come in a bit softer, and, you know, that would have made their job more straightforward and made the case that maybe the economy would be ready for interest rate cuts later this year. This time, I think we're just going to, you know, wait and see and wait for more data.
You know, it's interesting, Neela, you have not said the word wages yet. Nice wage gains, right?
Mm. Yeah, 4.1%. That's very strong. And from the worker point of view, that means that average hourly earnings are above inflation. And I think workers like that. But from the Fed's point of view, it means that wages are still running hotter than they were before the pandemic. And you know that ADP provides similar data on pay based on paychecks. And we've seen that in May, pay growth was higher this month than it was earlier in this year. So we're not seeing that consistent downward pattern in wage growth. And wages are the bridge between the labor market and inflation. So if it's still strong and robust, it means the Fed still has to worry about it.
Anna, what, you know, you're a reporter that covers the global economy and trade. I wonder what, if anything, you make just on that idea of the Fed not yet taking conclusive action. The European Central Bank this week did, in fact, take conclusive action. They lowered their rate a quarter of a percentage point, despite the differences in the economy. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that was interesting. So for in Europe, inflation is a bit closer to the bank's 2% target than it is in the U.S., but it's also a pretty bumpy path there as well. That move did spark some conjecture about whether they were jumping the gun and they had to kind of reassure everyone that they're also going to be data dependent. They aren't just jumping into this new cutting cycle. They're going to wait and see what happens. In the U.S., you know, inflation has been a little bit stickier. And U.S. officials are just waiting a bit more to have more confidence that inflation is moving downward compared to where European officials are at.
Neela, go ahead.
If I could just add on to that, I view ECB's move as really a down payment on rate cuts rather than a full-throated support of getting rates back down to a lower level. They actually saw a benchmark policy rate that was at record highs. And remember that these two big central banks don't always follow each other in lockstep. Before the pandemic, ECB's rates were negative. The Fed would never go below zero, or at least they've stated that they wouldn't. So they don't always follow each other. They're not always in lockstep. And as Anna points out, they're slightly and meaningfully different economic conditions right now.
So, Anna, as we look forward in the next, 90 days in this economy, global or otherwise, what are you looking at?
I think that, you know, Neela was right to talk about wage growth. I mean, I think that's, you know, something that we definitely need to watch and continue to see if that picks up. But there were a lot of other interesting trends to watch this month, too. We saw the unemployment rate ticking up as well. What we'll want to see is, do we continue to see the data have a clearer trend now, or, you know, more of this divergent kind of messy picture?
Yeah. Neela, I was going to ask you the same question, but I'm going to change my mind because I get to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Today aside, right, the addition of 272,000 new jobs aside, it does look like the economy is slowing gradually and maybe not as quickly as the Fed wants it to get inflation down, but the economy is slowing.
there were pockets of weakness that we've been noticing all year. I'll put one of them as manufacturing in the goods sector.
Yep, yep.
And this is lined up with not just hard data, but also sentiment data that's pointing towards contraction, and manufacturing hasn't found its footing in the present economy. I think that's concerning. And then if you look at some of the tech layoffs, if you look at white collar jobs, there is some sense that there's a little bit of slowdown in layoffs there. And if you look at segments of workers like young people, there's a sense, and you actually saw it in today's report, that for young people, young workers, the labor force participation rate has tipped down. It's a little bit harder to find a job now than it was last year for the same age cohort. So there are pockets of weakness. We're not supposed to cheer those. Those are weaknesses that we'd like to see improve, and we'd like to see an overall balance, not just the healthcare sector leading the way, but more balanced hiring throughout the economy.
Right. Neela Richardson at ADP, Anna Swanson at the New York Times on a Friday afternoon. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
Wall Street today, subdued, I'd say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are obviously a zillion ways to slice and dice the monthly jobs report. We just did that for 7 minutes. The slice we're going to take right now is leisure and hospitality. The Bureau of Labor Statistics says we added 42,000 jobs there last month, up about 0.2% from April. And we are, of course, well into the leisure and hospitality season with summer travel and nice weather and people wanting to be out at restaurants and bars. And that, and those rising wages we were also talking about a minute ago, that translates into more jobs. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
Prices in restaurants and entertainment venues may be higher, but we Americans do like to treat ourselves. Rich Harrell directs the International Tourism Research Institute at the University of South Carolina.
The travel and tourism industry, it saw a sharp rebound after COVID. Some of that's still leveling off, but we're still seeing strong job growth in the United States.
And so, says Sean Snaith, director of the University of Central Florida's Institute for Economic Forecasting.
The owners of the restaurants and the hotels and these other leisure and hospitality related industries need to hire additional workers.
And while spending and hiring are up, the leisure and hospitality industry looks a little different than it did in the past. Hudson Reilly, a senior vice president of research at the National Restaurant Association, he says people are spending more on takeout and delivery, but...
For table service, that segment now has over 230,000 fewer positions than it did pre-pandemic. So overall, industry traffic patterns are dramatically different as a result of the pandemic also.
Also different, says Reilly, who is working in restaurants, which are hiring more than 500,000 seasonal workers this summer.
16 to 19-year-olds are much more likely to be employed in the industry than they were pre-pandemic. And the same is also true for the older cohorts, say age 60 and above.
Those older workers can be a big asset in a sector that's constantly hiring. Perhaps they're picking up a summer job in the industry to supplement their retirement income. In New York, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Maybe you've got some time set aside tonight or over the weekend to lounge on the couch and watch TV. If Netflix is part of that plan, well, it might look a little bit different. The streaming company said this week it's rolling out a redesigned TV app. The whole goal is to make it less cluttered, easier to navigate, and surprise, 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 more tempting to stay on the app for longer. Marketplace's Kelly Wells has more on what it might look like.
When Netflix did some research on its app and tracked where viewers' eyes were focused, the old design had them bouncing all over the screen. Pat Fleming with Netflix called it visual gymnastics.
It probably doesn't surprise you that we hear from time to time from members that it can be difficult to choose what to watch or what to play across thousands of options.
He works on the member product experience team at Netflix.
Our goal, given that broad range of interests folks have, and the broad, really broad set of options is to make Netflix simpler, more intuitive, and easier to navigate.
He says they've moved the menu from the side to the top, and now it's got fewer options. The title cards are bigger, and the text is simpler to read. That might not seem like a major overhaul, but it can have a surprising effect on churn, which just means the rate that people come and go. That's according to Neil Zuckerman, who chairs the Global Institute for the Future of Television at the Boston Consulting Group.
If it creates greater stickiness, if it stops someone from leaving for another service out of frustration, then it's obviously a good thing.
It's the first major change Netflix has made in a decade.
I think it's very much overdue.
Tim Hanlon is founder of a media industry consultancy called the Vertair Group. He says the new simpler layout will make it easier to get personalized recommendations to viewers.
Everybody can tell you a story about a YouTube rabbit hole or two or seven that they've gone through. It's frankly just short of amazing. And I think that's kind of where Netflix and other services are trying to go.
Only a fraction of Netflix's more than 260 million users are seeing the new layout already. The company says it'll take feedback and maybe make some changes before releasing it to everyone else. I'm Kaylee Wells for Marketplace.
You know what we release to you every single day? Our podcast. If you miss something on the air, that's where you ought to go, marketplace.org, or follow us on the platform of your choice, of course. Coming up.
People want their drugs without their drugs. Coffee still just lights up your brain in a way that nothing else does.
Poetic, don't you think? First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gave back 87 points today, 0.2%, finished at 38,798. The NASDAQ dropped 39 points, about a 0.25%, 17,133. The S&P 500 down 5 points, a 0.1%, 53.46. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow up 0.3%, the NASDAQ added 2.4%, the S&P 500 up 1.33%. Kelly Wells was telling us about the great redesign at Netflix. The streaming service dipped 1.1% today. Disney and Paramount edged up about 0.33% apiece. GameStop tumbled more than 39% today after posting first quarter sales that fell way short of expectations. Live by the meme, die by the meme, huh? You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Amazon Business. From small business to big enterprise and everything in between, Amazon Business helps simplify the supplies buying process. Amazon Business, your partner for smart business buying. And by the Peter G. Peterson Foundation, a nonpartisan organization dedicated to raising awareness and accelerating action on America's fiscal challenges to build a brighter economic future for the next generation. Learn more at pgpf.org.
Support for KQED comes from VisitorsCoverage.com, offering both inbound U.S. and outbound U.S. travel, medical, and trip insurance, so travelers are covered for financial risks and medical emergencies wherever they go. Learn more at VisitorsCoverage.com. And from Xfinity. With their Wi-Fi Boost Pod, in-home wall-to-wall Wi-Fi offers coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. Good afternoon. It's 4:17. I'm Michelle Hennigan. Julie Depesch will be here with your traffic update after Marketplace. At 4:30 on the California Report with Sasha Coca, we'll hear how composer Jens Ibsen is pushing the boundaries of classical music with inspiration from rock music. The California Report magazine comes on this afternoon at 4:30, and we'll have a repeat broadcast of the program this evening at 6:30 here on KQED Public Radio.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. On Christmas Day 2020 in Nashville, Tennessee, a bomb went off downtown. One person died, the man who set off the explosion, and more than 60 buildings were heavily damaged. All of the buildings on that street, already having a rough go of it because of the pandemic, right? All of them were hit hard. Some had to close completely. And 3.5 years later, as Cynthia Abrams from WPLN reports, things have not gotten much easier.
Oh, I knew the snake, I from the storm. inside Cerveza Jack's, a Mexican cantina in downtown Nashville, patrons munch on tacos and follow orders when the musician on stage leads a toast to George Strait.
Are y'all ready? Count three. One, two, three.
Yeah! It's not a full restaurant, but that might be in part because outside Cerveza Jack's, the sounds are not quite as melodic. Much of the street is under construction. That's because in 2020, a vehicle exploded here. It's just a block away from Nashville's ultimate tourist destination, Lower Broadway, a street filled with honky-tonks, live music, and more than 15 million visitors per year. Now, with construction crews ripping up and rebuilding Second Avenue, businesses have watched foot traffic decline.
My hope is that this is the worst that it's ever going to be at this point.
Frank Miller, Cerveza Jack's owner, says revenue is down 60% since construction began.
I've said that for 3 years now, and so it continues to prove me wrong.
Two doors down at Mike's Ice Cream, owner Mike Duguay points out much of the street's business relies on pedestrians turning onto the street from Broadway. Before the bombing, 27% of visitors turned onto Second Avenue.
After the bombing, just because of the look of the next block and the limited businesses, that number dropped to 20%. After the erection of the fences to tear up the street, that number dropped to 12%.
That's why there's a new local campaign called Turn the Corner, funded by a nonprofit and Nashville's Department of Transportation. They've put up big pink signs signaling that Second Avenue is open and that tourists should come and spend money. Lori Johnson, a disaster recovery consultant, says she's seen efforts like this across the globe as cities recover from things like earthquakes, terrorist attacks, or hurricanes.
I think New Orleans struggled with this after Hurricane Katrina and sort of restarting that tourist-based revenue. And, you know, hey, we're back. You know, it's a very typical campaign, you'll see.
Johnson says these initiatives can actually be more effective in kickstarting business than a surge of cash. At Mike's Ice Cream, signage is helping to attract customers, like Colleen Alton, who ordered a single scoop on a sugar cone. She's on vacation from the UK and wandered over from her nearby hotel. But she says it did feel difficult to get to Second Avenue.
It's kind of closed off without the trellis and everything outside. You'd see the front of the business more, whereas you're walking up close to it. It's only because we really saw the ice cream sign.
The Nashville City Council waived the usual permitting processes for affected businesses so they could build outdoor dining spaces, have live music, and advertise from sidewalks. Still, Mike Duguay says he is really looking forward to when construction wraps up.
By the time this construction is over in January of 2025, we will have not had anything near a normal year for 5 total years. That's a long time for any business to carry it.
He's been wanting to expand the ice cream shop, open up more seating on the second floor of his building, but all that's on hold until Second Avenue is rebuilt. In Nashville, I'm Cynthia Abrams for Marketplace.
Having a cup of coffee in the morning and at various points throughout the day is a worldwide phenomenon. According to S&P Global, coffee drinkers, of which I am one, put away 3 billion cups of coffee a day, bringing in north of $200 billion a year to the coffee industry at large. And increasingly, the portion of that coffee that is being served caffeine-free, decaf, is growing. Matt Kronsberg wrote about it for Bloomberg. Matt, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Tell me, first of all, about this big win that, oh my goodness, decaf coffee just had in a big competition.
Sure. Back in March, they held the Brewers Cup competition in Rancho Cucamonga, California. And it was a gathering of specialty coffee professionals, people who make beautiful triple lattes and, you know, just really fancy stuff. And so Wei Hong Zhang, a coffee maker from Houston, came and he won the Brewers Cup, which is for like pour over style coffee, but he won it with decaf, which is kind of like winning the Tour de France on a unicycle.
So look, I'm a coffee snob up front. Never had a cup of decaf that tastes like an actual decent cup of coffee. How did decaf get to this point where it's now winning these competitions?
It's been improving a lot over the years. Basically, since about 2007, the quality of the process of removing the caffeine improved, and it stopped being this kind of really harsh, chemically kind of a taste that people learned to expect. And as that happened, growers started getting more comfortable submitting better coffees to be decaffeinated. And so it was sort of a virtuous cycle where, you know, as the process improved, the beans improved. As the beans improved, the coffee tasted better and people got more willing to go long on it.
Yeah, amazing statistic in this piece. It's from SkyQuest Technology that you you quoted. Decaf market, decaf coffee only, from $20 billion a couple of years ago to almost $30 billion by the end of the decade. That's kind of amazing.
It is. I mean, it's enough to get your heart rate up a little bit, which is
even without the caffeine.
Great if the coffee isn't going to do
it. That's right. Which, of course, means companies are in on this thing. Blue Bottle is one. There's a bunch of others.
Yeah, no, and it's not just the big ones. I mean, companies like Blue Bottle always have a strong contingent of people who, for whatever reason, if they're pregnant or, you know, just anxiety issues or just coming in the afternoon wanting to have a decaf. But it also means that smaller roasters, smaller growers, you're really seeing it across the board. I spoke to Adam Peronto, who has a company in Chicago called Reprise Coffee Roasters, and they've gone even a little bit farther and are not just offering decaf, but a wider range of caffeinated levels. They've got, you know, the zero, which is 99.99% caffeine free, but they also offer a microdose that's only 10% caffeine and a light buzz that's 25%.
I suppose this shouldn't be surprising, this rise of decaf, in an era where non-alcoholic cocktails are a thing and non-meat products are a thing, right? I mean, people are, you know, they've got this on the mind.
Absolutely. I mean, and that was what Adam from Reprise said. He said, you know, people want their drugs without their drugs. Mm-hmm. Coffee still just lights up your brain in a way that nothing else does.
This Brewers Cup win has been compared to, you write, that very famous 1976, I think, win by California wines at this big competition in France, and American wine sales, you know, took off after that. Do you suppose decaf sales take off after this win?
Do I think they'll take off? Will they skyrocket? Probably not, but I think there's going to be continued steady growth, and people are going to go into their, you know, their favorite snobby kind of coffee places and seeing decaf put front and center. And I think that's going to, changing perceptions takes time.
Yeah.
But it's very much on the right path. And actually, decaf has grown in sales faster than regular coffee every year for the last 7 years.
Are you a decaf guy or are you a high test guy?
I'm a high test guy.
Yeah.
But I'm coming around to it. I've had some really beautiful cups of decaf, and it's making me think that an afternoon cup could be part of my ritual soon.
I'm going to have to try it. Matt Kronsberg, writing at Bloomberg about decaf. Matt, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Marketplace is supported by NinjaOne, the endpoint management platform that automates the hardest parts of IT and helps your employees be more productive and secure no matter where they work at NinjaOne.com. And by How We Survive, a podcast from Marketplace. Climate change is dire, but there are ways we can make a difference. Listen to the new season of How We Survive wherever you get your podcasts.
This final note on the way out today, a callback to the story that Sabree did for us the other day on the wealth effect, how people just feel better off when the stock market is up, which then, of course, affects how they spend. Anyway, from the Federal Reserve today, this item, aggregate household wealth in this economy in the first quarter of this year, up 3.3% to almost $161 trillion. Again, that's the aggregate. Most of it, of course, came from gains in the stock market, almost $4 trillion. Real estate appreciation was another trillion or so. Kind of seems like play money, doesn't it? Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Donna Tam is the executive editor. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We are back on Monday. This is APM.
At 429, there is traffic trouble on the Sunol grade. With the details, here's Julie Deppish.
We've got a new wreck here on northbound 680 before Sheridan Road. A big rig and a car got into it. Doesn't look like they're blocking, but traffic is crawling anyway back to Automall Parkway. The overturned Army truck's been a problem in San Leandro for a couple of hours. East 580 at 164th Avenue, still blocking the two left lanes and traffic jam back to the zoo. We've got trouble on the peninsula, Redwood City, South 101 before Whipple. It's a hit and run crash. You'll see that on the right shoulder. Julie Deppish for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Murphy McKenna Construction. The California Report Half Hour Magazine is coming up next. Support for KQED comes from Broadway SF, presenting Company, the Tony-winning best revival of a musical that reimagines one of Stephen Sondheim's most beloved works. At the Orpheum Theater now through June 29th, tickets at BroadwaySF.com. And from Canyon Ranch Woodside, inviting guests to find their path to well-being at its retreat in the Redwoods, minutes south of San Francisco. Weekend packages available. Visit CanyonRanch.com for more info.
Support for the California Report comes from Stanford Medicine, comprising its School of Medicine and Adult and Children's Health Systems, working together to advance knowledge and improve lives. StanfordMedicine.org. The William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who are working to ensure that people, communities, and the planet can flourish. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
California's got such a rich musical history, and this year we're celebrating it by highlighting composers from across the state.
This place has people from all over the world.
We need to keep this energy from composers of all kinds of marginalized backgrounds.
I actually want as many different people from as many different cultures when they come in. I want them to feel valued.
Being a hip-hop artist, creating original works that incorporate orchestra.
We all have to want to go on an adventure, and I guess if we don't, you shouldn't play the piece.
I captivate them like Kaepernick with the Afro pick, raise the black fist, activists, shut down establishments, catalyst, no category for this, no data recorded, hip-hop musician, rooted classical origins, yo.
I'm Sasha Coca, and it's the California Report Magazine. When you think of the word composer, you might imagine a somber classical music concert hall. But for composer Jens Ibsen, that is not at all the case. He puts a spin on classical music, infusing it with prog rock and metal. And his bold and non-traditional style is getting a lot of attention from institutions like the San Francisco Symphony. Jens Ibsen is a lot of different things at once, and you can see that reflected not just in his music, but also in who he is as a person. Reporter Jessica Carissa met him at his home in Pacifica.
When it comes to classical training, Jens Ibsen is the real deal. He's been singing semi-professionally since he was 8 years old. He studied opera and composition, and as a composer, he's written pieces for chamber choirs and opera. But in recent years, he's attracted a lot of buzz for his pieces that push the boundaries of classical music. One example is the piece Overdrive, which he wrote for string quartet and takes inspiration from metal music. He's also gotten praise for his debut for the San Francisco Symphony, a piece named Drowned in Light, which he calls an electric guitar concerto. The marriage of metal and classical isn't new. Metallica famously collaborated with the San Francisco Symphony in 1999. But it's one thing for the metal band to go classical. It's another thing for the classical guy to go metal. For Jens, that blend of cultures and styles is central to who he is. I first met Jens at his childhood home in Pacifica, in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Hello.
Hi, Jens?
Yeah.
Just his outfit alone said so many different things about him.
I have these Gurkha pants on. This is a sort of military garment, actually. And I have this, it's a sort of turquoise, yellow, black, and white shirt on. This is from Ghana. This was made for me while I was there.
British military pants, an African print shirt, and a denim jacket with patches of metal bands, Ashanti cymbals, and a quote from Jimi Hendrix. At a distance, you'll see a young, fashionable guy. But the details tell a fuller story about his cultural background. Like his multicolored shirt from Ghana. That's where he was born and where his mother's from. His father is American.
Music is kind of the reason why I'm around.
His father developed a passion for the drums and decided to travel to Ghana to absorb everything he could about the instrument.
He wanted to learn more about drumming from the source. And so he went there on vacation and, you know, to make an extremely long story short, he met my mother and came back with a whole new family. So
Jens and his twin sister moved to the Bay at just 10 months old. And the soundtrack to their early childhood included lots of African and Latin American music.
Really, for the majority of my life, the music that I listened to for pleasure was not in English, just kind of as a result of my like pretty multicultural upbringing.
His own entry into music, though, would start outside the home. When he was in elementary school, a music teacher suggested he try singing.
And one day she sent me home with a poster for the choir, and I talked to my dad about it, and I had this sort of like perverse mental calculus that I did in my head, because I was like, well, if I become a singer, then I'll be cool. And if I'm cool, that means girls will like me. And that's all the motivation I needed as an 8-year-old.
In the end, singing ended up becoming more personal for Jens. It became less of a way to impress others and more of a way to feel at ease with himself.
Singing was one of the few things that I was happy about. I had a pretty difficult childhood. I felt pretty ostracized and like not integrated, you know, into the school communities that I was in. You know, it was one of the few things I just actually just felt good doing.
And Jens was really good at it. Soon he joined the Grammy Award-winning Palo Alto Boys Choir Ragazzi, where he learned to sing in different languages like German, French, and Italian. Then, purely by chance, he got the opportunity of a lifetime for a very young male singer. He auditioned for the Vienna Boys Choir.
I don't think I've ever been more nervous in my life.
He didn't have any reason to be. He aced it and was immediately offered a spot, becoming the first African-born member of the Vienna Boys Choir. He packed up and moved to a palace in Austria where the boys go to school, live, and sing full-time. He was elated. At 11 years old, he became a first. But like any first, it wouldn't be without its own particular challenges.
I've never experienced more overt racism than I did when I lived in Austria. I was ostracized for literally everything I did. Like, everything I did was seen as alien and foreign, and yet also somehow proof that I had an inflated sense of superiority down to how I got my hair done, to how I talked, to the fact that because of the language barrier, I often wouldn't know what was going on and I would miss meetings. I was hazed the entire time I was there. So that was really, really difficult.
Ultimately, Jens says he doesn't regret his decision to go. And after 2.5 years with the Vienna Boys Choir, he came back home to Pacifica and joined the Ruth Asawa San Francisco School of the Arts. He felt appreciated there and welcomed for his talent. That's where he first started composing music. He took inspiration from his classical training and Japanese video game music.
one of my big influences as a child was the game composer Yoko Shimomura, who's Japanese and has done stuff for Street Fighter, but like where I connected with her work was through the Kingdom Hearts games. And so her soundtrack for those games was really piano forward. And so I think that's why I was thinking of a piano piece at the time, because I just was really into her stuff.
Diving down a rabbit hole of Japanese music led him to metal music and to Dear on Grey. That band has been a major influence on his recent compositions.
Discovering them was sort of a moment like, oh, music can be like this. Like, I just didn't know. And it also made me experiment as a vocalist more with my range, because I just was like, oh my God, like, you have these metal guys like singing notes that you never hear in opera, you know?
When it comes to writing music, Jens doesn't wait for inspiration to strike. He tells me that remembering to write music is like remembering to turn the stove off at night. It's routine. It's necessary.
I'm very disciplined about writing. Like, I sit down and I set a chunk of time and I just do it. And I'll revise it later until it's perfect. Because if you have something down, you can decide how you feel. But if you have nothing, you've got nothing.
Jens has composed for chamber choirs, for string quartets, and he's currently writing a children's opera. But these days, almost every idea starts the same way, on his phone.
I'll often make voice notes or text notes or both. If you even read one of these notes, you're not going to have any idea what it's going to sound like. It's just enough for me to be able to recall what I've stored internally. It's more like I'm creating these verbal triggers for myself.
One of his most recent pieces, De Profundis, was commissioned by the professional choir Volti in San Francisco and premiered in February. It started as a text note on his phone. I asked him to read it for me.
I have so splintered pulses with hand mutes over a tonal center of F, tenor solo of the words quia apud te. That's the Latin text of the piece.
This is what it sounds like in rehearsal.
And then we have another section, Susti nuit anima mea, and then I say, borrow the descending figure you did in the last version.
De Profundis is based on something he wrote in high school. His style is not only multi-genre, it also fuses past and present to make something new. In 2022, Jens won the second annual Emerging Black Composers Award. The prize was a $15,000 commission, which ended up becoming Drowned in Light. After facing such brutal racism in the Vienna Boys Choir, receiving such a distinguished award, in part because of his race, is complicated.
For a while, I felt cynical because it felt like, well, I've been good this whole time, why now? But the way I see it now is I think I look back on the cynicism and I have a little more empathy for myself because I can see that these people like me because they believe in my art.
Jens hopes his story can inspire others of all kinds of backgrounds to continue to push the boundaries of music and be recognized for it.
Jessica Carissa brought us that profile of composer Jens Ibsen. Stay tuned to hear more of our California Composers series over the next few months. If you drive through downtown Riverside, you might spot a building surrounded by giant sculptures three stories high made of recycled bottles. Or the mariachi band sculpted from metal and decorated with colorful bottle caps, along with hundreds of other art pieces made entirely of what most people would call trash. This is Tio's Tacos. It's not only a Mexican restaurant, it's a sculpture garden and an immigrant entrepreneur's labor of love. For our Hidden Gem series, KQED's Daniel Eduardo Hernandez took a trip back to his hometown to meet the owner and creator of the Tio's Tacos Wonderland.
It's practically impossible to miss the entrance to Tio's Tacos, Just drive off the 91 freeway onto Mission Inn Avenue and stop when you see a huge orange butterfly hanging off the side of a building. You'll see an airplane parked on the roof and two giants made from recycled aluminum cans taller than the buildings behind them. Those sculptures only scratch the surface. Martin Sanchez leads me through the hundreds of other recycled works of art that surround his business. He points out a statue called The Dance of the Old Man. It represents a traditional style of dance from his hometown of Sahuayo in the state of Michoacán. His love for his culture is reflected in many of his pieces. His art also tells another story. It represents his journey to heal a part of himself that he sacrificed a long time ago. He says when he was young, his family couldn't afford toys.
Pero yo formaba mis propios juguetes. Yo hacía mis carreteritas con diferentes tierras.
So he decided to make some out of scrap metal he found lying around. He loved to tinker as a kid and says other children loved to play with his creations as well. But after his father passed away when he was a young boy, he had to work to help provide for his family. Years later, in 1984, he decided to immigrate to the United States. He was 16 and found a job selling oranges on the side of the road in East LA. He says his Mexican spirit led him to start a taco and hot dog stand business.
Lo que en el día vendía hot dog y en la noche vendía tacos. Entonces transformaba el carrito para vender tacos. Y así es donde nace Tío's Tacos.
After 6 years of operating out of a cart, Martin saved enough money to buy the land where Tio's Tacos stands today. But as he was growing his business, he felt a pressure building up inside of him that needed to be released. He says it was his inner child wanting to be free.
Saco el niño que traigo dentro, saco el niño que frustré, que tuve que congelar para ponerme a ser responsable como adulto siendo niño.
He says as a kid, he had to grow up too fast and take on a lot of responsibility. But now he could let that kid out and be creative.
Entonces cuando llego a ese punto, ya siendo adulto, yo saco ese niño y es donde empieza el arte.
When Martin started his artistic journey, he quickly realized that he didn't have the funds to invest in materials. But recalling his childhood antics, he found inspiration in the stuff his restaurant discarded.
Yo le vi la oportunidad a la basura, al reciclaje. Okay, no tengo dinero para comprar los materiales, pero tengo botellas, tengo botes, tengo lo que desecha el restaurante.
He neatly separated the empty bottles and cans into different piles for upcoming projects he envisioned in his head. Eventually, the land behind the restaurant was full of trash, and it caught the attention of the local government. His neighbors filed complaints against his collection, but Martin says as they saw this public eyesore turn into a work of art, the complaints slowed down.
Han de haber dicho, este loco hay que dejarlo a ver hasta dónde llega. Hoy en día, gracias a Dios, tengo el apoyo de la ciudad. Me apoyan, me felicitan. Soy un landmark ya, como le llaman aquí.
He says at a certain point, everyone decided to see just how far he would take his passion. His neighbors support him now and see Tio's Tacos as a landmark.
He's creating place here in Riverside, and it's a destination. It's a place where people go and see themselves, see their family, their history, their memories.
Maria Esther Fernandez is the artistic director of the Chich Marin Center for Chicano Art and Culture in Riverside. It's only a couple blocks away from the restaurant and has featured Martin's work. But Martin's place isn't just about the art. People also come for the food, and it's not hard to understand why. I dig into a plate of tacos, rice, beans, and chips.
I'm not a food critic because I think all food is good. And I could never be a food critic because I don't want to get people mad at me. But this is really good.
It's really good. I got a little surprised by some things that I thought were pineapples, but they were actually oranges.
That's Candy Hollinger. It's her first time at Tio's Tacos, and she just bought her second ever michelada. She joked that the drink was part fruit salad, because of the mixture of shrimp and fruit decorating the top of the cup. Martin says he prides himself in making his food authentic, so he often travels to different parts of Mexico to learn more about the food of his culture.
Y me venía con ese sabor en la mente y llegaba a mi negocio y empezaba a jugar con las especies y la comida.
He says every town has a unique flavor and style to their cooking. His travels inspired him, and now he experiments with the newfound flavors in his restaurant.
Quítale, ponle, agrégale, cocínalo más, cocínalo menos, hasta que el punto que yo traía en la mente llegaba, y así es como nace auténticamente mexicana el sabor.
He's happy with the legacy he built. His three daughters are gradually inheriting the business. Estefanie, Kimberly, and Maiten all work at the restaurant. Maiten says they've already made some changes to the menu.
Esa bebida es un poco más nueva y también agregamos como chía con perejil.
They've added some healthier ingredients like chía and parsley to their agua frescas. The oldest, Estefanie, says she also plans to preserve the art and continue growing the restaurant.
Siempre hemos dicho que el restaurante es como una, es algo viviente, que respira y se mueve y está cambiando constantemente. Hay cosas nuevas, entonces ese sería nuestro trabajo.
She says the restaurant is something that's living, breathing, and constantly growing, and that it's her job to keep it alive. For Martin, he's happy to hand the business over to his daughters. It gives him more time to create art.
Yo soñé como un niño y yo sigo soñando como un niño y sigo jugando con un niño. Entonces cada que hago un proyecto, yo me pongo a pensar que estoy jugando. Y esa es la clave del éxito para lograr algo.
He says he still dreams and plays like a boy. And that's the key to his success.
That's KQED's Daniel Eduardo Hernandez speaking to Martin Sanchez at Tio's Tacos in Riverside. You can check out more of our Hidden Gems series at kqed.org/hiddengems. And now we're going to head to Santa Cruz to hear about another kind of creative recycling. You probably know Santa Cruz has played a really big role in surfing history. It's where Hawaiian princes introduced the sport to California back in 1885. And it's where surfers first started using wetsuits back in the 1950s. Since then, Santa Cruz has been on the cutting edge of a lot of modern surf technology. Now, a new company is hoping to build on that history and help the sport become more environmentally friendly by making surfboards out of recycled hospital trays. KAZU's Aaron Malsbury went to check out how these surfboards get made.
In a Santa Cruz garage, a huge homemade metal machine lays a clear plastic filament down, row by row. It's a 3D printer, which uses a digital file to create a three-dimensional object. Over the next couple of days, the rows will form a surfboard.
This was the first board that sparked the drive for everything else.
That's Patricio Guerrero, pulling a finished board out of a rack next to the printer. It's hollow and translucent, with a diamond-shaped lattice pattern running through it. It almost looks like frosted glass. Patricio started printing surfboards in his garage in the fall of 2022. He tested the first one at the most famous surf spot in Santa Cruz, Steamer Lane. People have been surfing there since the 1930s, and Steamer Lane has seen plenty of homemade boards, but none made from a 3D printer.
I was super nervous. Man, maybe I'll just jump in the water and the whole thing will like just break right under me.
But the board worked. Patricio surfed for 2 hours. From there, he started printing more boards using recycled materials and founded a startup, which he called SwellCycle. Surfboards are an estimated $13 billion global industry. It's hard to say exactly how many boards are made each year. They're made by big manufacturers and also in people's garages, but it's somewhere in the tens of millions. And most of them are not exactly eco-friendly. Most surfboards start as a plastic foam block called a blank, with a thin piece of wood running down the middle. They're then shaped and covered in fiberglass and plastic resin. The foam cores in most surfboards can't easily be recycled, and they don't biodegrade. Old or broken surfboards usually end up in landfills, where they crumble into smaller and smaller pieces that can pollute water and soil. But 3D printed boards don't need foam. They're mostly hollow, and they can be made from recycled plastic.
You can basically melt it down and create a filament that then you feed into your printer.
For SwellCycle, Patricio started ordering filament made from recycled hospital trays. Soon, he recruited a business partner to design the boards and sent them to local surfboard shapers for the final fiberglassing. Vince Broglio was the first to work with one of Patricio's boards, but today I visit his shaping room to see the process he's been using for almost 40 years.
you'll have two different types of blanks. One's a polyurethane and one's a EPS, expandable foam.
In a little two-room shack with an ocean view, he uses a planer and then hand sands a foam blank.
Hand shaping a blank, that will take me about 2 hours.
The walls are lined with photos of waves and shelves packed with materials.
Here are my rolls of fiberglass, carbon fiber, polyester resin, epoxy resin. Yeah.
You can definitely smell it.
After lots of sanding comes the fiberglass and resin coating. This is the smelly step, and it's somehow even messier than sanding the foam. Just outside the door, Vince has pinned up four pairs of tennis shoes, completely covered in hardened drips of colorful plastic resin.
When you're laminating a board or glassing, you're putting the fiberglass and resin on the board and putting out a finished product.
I wasn't able to see Vince work with a 3D printed board, but he says,
it looked really cool when it was done. You know, see-through board and all that.
He says it can be hard for surf culture to accept new things, but printing is just another tool.
I know there's going to be guys that are like, oh my God, the soul of it's gone. But, you know, you got to have somebody that knows surfing, that's been shaping, to design the board in the first place.
Swellcycle prototyped more boards and kept working with local shapers. Eventually, big wave surfer Tyler Fox tried one out.
The sustainability element that these boards are using recycled plastics, and they can also get recycled at the end of their life cycle, was something that really excited me as well.
Tyler says the boards also catch people's eye in the water.
Like midday, where the sun's shining right through it on a green wave, it just glows. It's like you're on a hovercraft, like this glowing hovercraft, and it's pretty neat to see how excited people get.
On a sunny morning, on the cliff above the surf spot Steamer Lane, people gather around the printed surfboards.
Dude, it's trippy how it's kind of see-through.
What's it made out of? Like, what material?
Hospital trays.
Wow. No way.
A surfer named Antonio Ramirez has just finished trying one out.
It feels great. I love it. It was smooth, fast, and loose.
The 3D printed boards have also earned the approval of local legend Bob Pearson, who founded Pearson Aero Surfboards in the 60s. He now ships boards to pro surfers around the world. At the massive Pearson Aero factory in Santa Cruz, he points out boards going to Japan and Hawaii. They're potato chip thin, 6 foot long shortboards and thick, sharply pointed 10 foot boards for big waves.
We make six boards a day. We've been doing that for years. We've made well over 100,000 boards. We sell them internationally.
He says the current process has room for improvement.
We do a amount of polyurethane and EPS, expanded polystyrene. There's a lot of waste. That waste goes to landfill. That's not a good thing.
When the Swellcycle team first approached him, Bob was skeptical.
Because a lot of people bring things in that are really funky. They showed it to me and picked it up, and I was impressed. Very impressed.
He compares the 3D printing technology to when he started using a CNC machine, which automatically sands a board to match a shape designed on a computer. He remembers how people criticized him for not doing everything by hand.
But I was one of the first guys to have these in the world, and I got all kinds of crap for having a CNC machine because people didn't know what the hell it was. It takes a soul out of it, and everyone was bad-mouthing it. And it's amazing how many people are bad-mouthing it now are utilizing them.
A few of the Swellcycle boards have been finished at the factory, and Bob thinks there's a place in the market for them.
And I was stoked. Stoked from the day one. Great idea. 3D printing a surfboard. Unreal.
The Swellcycle team recently moved out of Patricio's garage and into a solar-powered warehouse in Santa Cruz. And they just unveiled a 10-foot longboard, which will open up their market to newer surfers and people who prefer bigger boards. Now, they're looking for surfers to try out the boards and provide long-term feedback. It'll be the first real test of whether the surfing community is ready for something new.
That was KAZU reporter Aaron Malsbury in Santa Cruz. And that's it for the California Report magazine. Our senior editor is Victoria Maleon. We had additional editing this week from Pauline Bartoloni. Susie Racho is our director producer. Our engineer is Brendan Willard. Lucen Mendel is our intern. And I'm Sasha Coca. You can catch all of our California stories on our podcast, The California Report Magazine. Your state, your stories.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. Monterey Bay Aquarium, inspiring conservation at the ocean through amazing live exhibits and global action to protect the ocean from plastic pollution, climate change,